The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
To the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
Our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is Holocaust survivor Emmanuel Manny Mandel. Sir, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Your family was from Hungary, but you were actually born in Latvia, correct?
Correct.
And when was that?
1936.
And how young were you when you moved back to Hungary?
Oh, anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks old.
Oh, so very young.
Yeah. My parents had planned to go back to Hungary. My father had a job in Hungary. He had terminated his employment in Latvia, and they were just waiting for me to be like, not old enough, but I mean to be a little bit larger than brand new. That's all.
And your father was taking a fairly prominent position in Hungary.
Yes.
What was that?
My father was a cantor all his life, and his dream in life was to become one of the chief cantors of Budapest. There were four of them in one of the major synagogues in Budapest, which he was able to arrange in 1936. Thus, he went back to Hungary. He had been the chief cantor of the city of Riga for 3 years prior to that.
1936, Adolf Hitler is in power. He had not begun his conquest yet, but the persecution of the Jews in different ways had begun. What was life like in your earliest memories?
The persecution actually didn't really happen anywhere and that early. You need to remember that Hungary had a relationship with the Nazi government, which is unlike any other country except for Italy. They were allies. As a consequence, the Holocaust comes to Hungary quite late. The war is a much larger issue in Hungary in 39, 40, 41, 42 than the Holocaust is.
In what way? How did the war affect the public then?
Bombing every day. We had, I mean, not in 39, but in 41, 42, the Russians bombed from one side and the Allies bombed from the other side because Hungary was an ally of Germany, it was an enemy. As a consequence, when I got up in the morning when I went to first grade, I was not certain that the building next door to us would be standing.
Were your parents aware of what was going on in the Jewish community during that time?
This isn't so much a Jewish community, it's the community at large.
Right.
They were still listening to the broadcast from England on the BBC's Hungarian service, while we could still do that. As you know, Europeans, to this day perhaps, I don't know, had to have licenses for radios. So as long as we had a license for the radio, we could listen to broadcasts. And I remember as a very young child, I don't know exactly when, I was kind of puzzled and maybe upset that they were very pleased to hear a little later on that the Allies were advancing in North Africa. It was confusing to me because, after all, the people here, the Hungarians, no Nazis, just not Nazis, yes, but not the Germans. The Hungarians on the street, the military on the street, I thought was my home team. I was wrong, of course. They were kind of glad that the home team was losing. And that's very puzzling for a child.
Sure. So they understood exactly what was going on.
Of course.
How much were they aware of what was happening in other countries, whether it's Germany or Poland or other countries?
Later, a great deal. It depends on when. I don't think they had a great deal of knowledge about anything as the war began. Kristallnacht in 1938 in Germany, the invasion of Poland in 1939, those, the annexation of Austria, those were kind of happenings in history which did not impact on us directly, and I don't think they gave too much of a hang about that. It did not impact on our daily lives. Our travel was unrestricted at the time. We went on vacations still. I think that all commerce was going on. There were some limitations on school, on professions, but they would not impact, you know, on a child. So I don't know if they were particularly concerned. I can tell you one thing. The concern did not become real until very late, until too late. I heard my father say, as many, many, many people said, what do you mean it's going to be a problem? It's going to blow over.
So there was
not quite.
There was the assumption that because Hungary was aligned with Germany, that the same problems that were happening elsewhere would not come to Hungary?
And also we saw ourselves as very good Hungarians. There was an emancipation of the Jewish community in the 19th century, and as a consequence, Jews had prominent positions, and they never expected anything to happen, much as the Germans, the Jews, did not expect anything to happen to them. It was a major kind of a awakening when things began to happen. I can tell you anecdotally, my grandfather, my father's father, whom I never knew, he died before I was born. Once he lived in a little village, and he was kind of a local, kind of a, some kind of registrar. He did not do very well in business, and he had a kind of a, like a government job of sort. My grandfather went to Budapest for some kind of a meeting and came back, my father tells me, and was so tremendously proud of seeing the Hungarian soldiers and the Hungarian police with their cockadoodle hats and their feathered hats. I mean, these were his people. The Hungarian Jewish community felt themselves as being very Hungarian. At no point did that disturb the Jewishness. But they were ethnically very Hungarian and figured, why should they have any kind of problems? Any more than any non-Jew in Hungary. It didn't turn out that way.
You were talking earlier about the confusion as a young boy of having your family hope that the Hungarian forces would ultimately lose because they were aligned with the wrong side in the war. Was that uniformly the belief, as far as you could tell, inside the Jewish community in Budapest?
Well, I'm not sure that they were concerned about it in that way, but they were perhaps, I would say I was concerned and confused and puzzled. They were just puzzled.
Things did, of course, deteriorate there, and you tell the story of your father accompanying you to school.
The protection here was kind of a prophylactic one. Not everybody who went to school was, in fact, whacked on the head. But when I was in first grade and I had to wear a yellow star, I thought the yellow star was one of the finest things in the whole world because, after all, I was a little guy, 6 years old, just like the adults. And I thought that was a mark of distinction until I discovered that it was not a mark of distinction, which I can tell you about whenever you're ready for me to begin to tell you how I discovered that. He would follow me to school, or somebody would follow me to school, just to see to it that somebody doesn't whack me on the head. Not because he wanted my books, my coat, or my shoes. It was like open season. It didn't happen to me, and it didn't happen to everybody. It happened to some. And my father was seeing to it that either he or somebody would follow me so it doesn't happen, even though we lived perhaps three blocks from the school. We lived at number 11 of the street, and the school was at number 44. We could see the school from my parents' bedroom on the fifth floor of the building, which is the top floor of our apartment building. So it was pretty safe in many ways, but there was some concern. There must have been some noises in the neighborhood, and that was kind of a protective device that they employed. I began to understand that differently when I was maybe seven, a little after seven. My father was home from his various incarcerations, if you will, in labor camp. And I'll tell you about labor camp anytime you want to hear it, but let me not deal with that for the moment. He was home, and I said to him, Pop, would you consider please buying me a bicycle? I had like a tricycle of sorts, kind of a large trike, but I was 7 years old. I could ride a bike. I couldn't ride a full-size bike, but I could ride maybe like an 18-inch bike. So he said to me, well, there are two problems. One I can solve, the other one I will not solve. The first problem is that we live on the fifth floor of this building. The elevator is out of service as much as it's in service, because the parts for the 50-year-old elevator need to be manufactured by the same factory that is now doing munitions and war material. And the elevator parts are very low on the priority list. Okay? So I would have the bike trucked downstairs. We'd go out to the park, you'd ride and come back. He says, I'm willing to do that. I mean, I personally could not handle a bike down five flights of stairs. It just wasn't big enough. My father could. But the second problem is a different one. The second problem is one whereby if you are riding in the park with the yellow star on your chest, and you're out of my sight for 12 seconds or whatever, somebody can whack you on the head, not because they want to steal the bike. They don't want the bike. They just want to whack you on the head. And for that reason, I'm not going to get you a bike. Now, besides being terribly disappointed, I also began to understand that maybe the star is not a mark of distinction, but a target. And it began to dawn on me that something must be going on here that makes me identified with that star differently than the kids next door to me in the apartments, two girls, with whom I was very friendly, and they were not Jewish kids, so they had no yellow star.
So that was the point where your father felt you could begin to understand why the star was not meant to be a mark of distinction.
Well, he knew that.
Sure.
But I began to understand it.
So they protected you for the first couple of years.
Absolutely. Well, they protected me the whole time. I was very much in a bubble. But I began to have the insight into why the star is a problem, and through that, I understand there must be something going on which makes us either different or something. Remember, there was nothing that happened on a day-to-day basis that would give me any... Well, things happened, yes, but not that would in any way impact on me specifically. Law was passed that the Jewish community could not have telephones. Man comes to the door and says, I have to take your phone. Now, that's a problem to my father. He used the phone at work. I didn't use the phone at work. So having a phone gone was not a problem to me. But I knew that was happening. Again, the answer to the question why was not available. The maid that we had, most middle-class families employed maids who lived in the maid's quarters in our apartment. She had a room and a bath, and she was a very nice little 18-year-old young woman from the farm. She would help my mother, but remember, in those days, there's no washing machine, no drying machine, no microwave, no... We had a gas range, yes. No refrigerator, no freezer. Shopping was once or twice a day. But all of the conveniences of today just didn't happen. They didn't happen anywhere yet, and obviously Hungary, although as modern as it was probably 5 years behind the U.S. I asked my wife, who's... people ask if she's a survivor. I said, yes, of New Jersey. And I asked if she remembers when her parents did not have a refrigerator. She says she does not. She was also born in 1936. So we were 5 years or 8 years behind in that development, and a man came with the ice every 2 or 3 days. The ice would melt. We would dump out the water, and it would be fresh ice. But that required daily shopping. And all of that work that had to be done was done by my mother. When the maid had to go, because the maid was told that she no longer could work, be employed by Jews, that had an impact on me in that my buddy went. And she was 18 and I was 9, not even 9, 8, but she was the closest thing to my age. I mean, we didn't have philosophical discussions, but I don't know, we probably played tiddlywinks or something once in a while. And that had an impact. A severe impact? No. But an impact.
Manny, let's take a brief break right there. We'll pick up your story on Veterans Chronicles in just a moment.
This is the Radio America Network.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
We remember 24 hours a day.
We study the news and history.
We assemble information. We speak out.
And we listen to you.
And we don't forget that every pleasant minute of this freedom we owe to those who defend it.
So, here's to life.
The freedom of conscience.
And liberty.
Thank God Almighty!
And the pursuit of happiness.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
We're joined today by Emmanuel Manny Mandel. He is a survivor of the Holocaust. In the break, Manny, you said there's an important part of this story that emanates from Yugoslavia in the early 1940s, specifically 1941.
The winter of 41. My mother is from southern Hungary, which at the time was Yugoslavia. You have to remember that when after the First World War, Czechoslovakia was created, Hungary lost some territory because it lost the war the first time too, and northern Yugoslavia, which was ethnically Hungarian, became Yugoslavia. My mother is from that part of the world. She told the story that she was like 10 years old when the war ended in 1918. The teacher came into the class and said, okay, kids, when you come back to school on Monday, we're going to change language from Hungarian to Serbo-Croatian. Now, please understand, Serbo-Croatian and Hungarian don't have a common comma or period, let alone a word. Entirely different family of languages. But the kids were bilingual. It made no difference to them. That's not important, that just to describe Yugoslavia.
Sure.
My father's from Eastern Hungary, which some people understand to be the place from which we get Dracula. He's from Transylvania. In the winter of 41, my parents decided to go south, 3.5 hours by train, from Budapest to Novi Sad, which is a community in northern Yugoslavia, to visit my grandparents and my aunts. We could do that easily, and I was not yet in school, and it was just a family vacation. And we went, and we stayed with my mother's younger sister, in the apartment. I don't know what we did there. I don't recall. I do know that I did go to her husband's factory once. Oh, he had a cork factory. I don't remember what they did, but cork factory. 2 or 3 days into our vacation, one morning somebody comes up the stairs or the elevator, I don't remember, and says there's something funky going on the street. 5 minutes after that, knock, knock on the door, two policemen come up and say, ladies and gentlemen, you need to come outside. Please dress warmly. It's winter. It's not bitter, but it's winter. Put on boots and muffs and scarves and heavy coats and whatever. We need to do a census. We do a census in this country every 10 years. The Nazis felt that they had to do a census every 15 minutes. Now, that's an exaggeration, but they did it so frequently that they could control everybody's constant movement at any time, anywhere. I'm telling you this because this is my very first experience, which became to me the story of the Holocaust. And this I remember, had no understanding what went on, but I remember it. We are told to go out in the street, turn left and walk. Nobody bothered us. We walked for some time, a couple of hours at least. My father carried me, my mother carried me, and I walked. I'm 5.5 years old. I'm a little guy. And we arrived at a place which I recognized. On our left was a stockade fence about 8 foot high. On the right was a street and on the sidewalk. Now, I recognize this because in European cities, if they're not on the lake or the ocean, people make beaches out of rivers. And in the summertime, which I remember from the previous summer, I'd been there before, was a place which had wave pools and hot pools and thermal pools and restaurants and amusement parks, a lovely place along the beach. But this is winter, and the ice is 3 feet thick. As we're walking down along this stockade fence, we noticed that the doors, the gates to the fence where people went in are open, and people go down there and make a left turn towards the river, which is probably 200 or 300 yards down from the gate. As this is taking place, there's a police officer standing on the right side and says to my father, Mister, what are you doing here? My father says, I'm visiting my family. He says, oh, that's fine. That's not the problem. The problem is, you're not from here. I know that because I was brought in for this particular program from Budapest. And I'm a foot policeman a block from where you live, and I've seen you on the street many, many, many times. I recognize you. We talked earlier about my father having a pretty prominent position in the community. He was recognizable. He says, if we count you in the census, you'll mess up the numbers. Step aside. By this time, my aunts and my grandparents, some other folks, a dozen people or so, some of whom belonged in the community, got together. We all step aside. Within minutes, if a minute even took place, of that activity, the staff car comes down the main road, the uniformed guy comes out, has a powwow with the rest of his buddies, and gets on the bullhorn and says, ladies and gentlemen, the requirements of the census have been met. Please go home. The adults didn't have the foggiest possible idea of what just took place. We go home to my aunt's house, and my other aunt, my mother's other sister, is calling all day long. She says, we had some plans. Where were you? We tell her, and she says, well, 7:30 in the morning, two police came to my house. I invited them for coffee and cake. They asked me 3 questions and left. As this conversation continues, my parents find out that what had happened that morning early was that the ice in the river had been blasted up by cannon fire. People were marched to the river, shot in the back into the river. In Hungarian, it's called a razzia, a senseless, meaningless, purposeless, and useless exercise in power, because I can do this to you and there's nothing you can do about it. 350 people were killed. Something happened in the hinterland, someplace, one of the communities, some partisan activity, which was already beginning. Somebody exploded a truck or a railroad tie or something, and in order to in some way punish the community, this pogrom took place. Not unlike what we know had happened 3 years before in Berlin called Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass. But this particular experience, which I had no idea as to what happened, but I can describe it to you very clearly, is my first experience with this terrible thing that was looming in my future, called Holocaust.
We'll take another short break and be right back on Veterans Chronicles.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great C and
air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.
I'm Greg Corumbus. This is Veterans Chronicles. We are honored to be joined in studio today by Emmanuel Manny Mandel. He is a survivor of the Holocaust, born in Latvia, grew up in Hungary. And, sir, you just shared the riveting story of what happened in Yugoslavia. I also would like to go back to a point you made in passing while talking about what life was like in Budapest. And that was the fact that your father, when you had the conversation with him about the bike, had just returned from one of multiple terms spent at a labor camp. What happened to him? Why was he sent there?
All Hungarian men were conscripted into the army. Matter of fact, they fought on the Russian front, as it happened, the Hungarian brigades. Now, Hungarian Jews were not. So they were conscripted into labor camps, labor battalions, well organized, to do the work that the men couldn't do, having to do with crater repair, and bomb repair, and some mining, and some agriculture, and railroads. The work that the men who would have had to do that could not do because they weren't there, the slave labor was pulled in. They had little garrison camps, and they were well organized. My father would get a phone call when we had a phone, or a note in the mail, because mail we did have, or somebody would come to the door and say, Mister, on Tuesday at 3 o'clock, you'll be at this train station. You'll be gone for a day, a week, a month, or an indeterminate period of time. This happened from 42 on. So my father was home and not home with absolute no predictability. In many ways, I hardly saw him from 42 to 44, and then later from 44 to 46, I didn't see him at all. But that had impact on me because when I'm in 42, I'm 6, and 43, 44, I'm between 6 and 8, my father is substantially out of my life. That has impact. I can't tell you precisely, you know, what it did. The bicycle is just one example of that. But it has impact, and that's one of the things that, if you add them up, adds up to my Holocaust remembrances and how it impacted on my life.
Of course, of course. Between 42 and 44, or even earlier than that, and 44, even as a young boy, were you able to see things getting worse and worse, or have your mother describe it to you as getting worse and worse?
You know, well, not substantially, because remember, we're living in our apartment. I'm going to my school. I have my friends, and for a boy 6 and 7 years old, that's about all there is. I remember having gone back to Budapest a couple of times since, obviously as an adult, and I remember Budapest having shrunk. That's because I'm bigger.
Sure.
And the point is that my city was, you know, probably 8 or 10 square blocks. That was my city. It's a much bigger city than that. But it didn't impact on me in a direct sense, and as I said a few minutes ago, in many ways, my parents put me, and I think other parents put other kids, in bubbles to essentially protect them from some of those things that they probably couldn't understand. And I can remember, and the understanding came much, much later. I mean, evolved when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, and so forth.
So you had no idea, beyond them keeping you in a bubble about what was happening in Hungary, you knew nothing about concentration camps before 1944.
Because it didn't happen. That's basically correct. A little earlier in 44, maybe late 43. You want to remember that in 1942, there was a conference called, in Berlin, called the Wannsee Conference, the Wannsee Villa. The building still stands. It has no significance. This is where people were called together for the purpose of coming up with the mechanics of the final solution to the Jewish problem, which we all know is to kill them all. And they appointed a man to manage this issue. Man by the name of Adolf Eichmann. Eichmann does a very good job. He clears the hinterlands of Jews in France and Belgium and Romania and God knows everywhere else. He gets to Hungary in March of 44. Now, by March of 44, this is incredibly late in the war. D-Day is in June of 44, and the war's over in May of 45. So that we have to understand that we knew that my grandparents, the ones I described before in Yugoslavia, were deported. My grandmother, my father's mother, was also deported. We weren't too sure as to where the deportation took them to and what their fate was. We found out later what their fate was. my grandmother, my father's mother, lived with us for a while. She had an apartment also in Budapest. But lived with us, but she had some difficulties with her feet. Maybe she had a little bit of touch of sugar as well. She had had about 11 kids, of whom 7 lived into adulthood. And my father used to take her to special places that they would build shoes for her. But for her to go up and down the stairs and air raids was very difficult. So my father and his brother, a younger brother who was a student in Budapest, decided what they should do is take her back to Cepe, which is the little village in Transylvania where my father was born. It had some lack of amenities, but it also had no bombing and no climbing of stairs. So she was in Cepe, and she was deported from Cepe. Because what Eichmann did is he collected all the people in the hinterland first, came to Budapest itself on March 19, 1944.
Describe what happened when he came.
The deportations began at the rate of 12,000 a day. That's what happened. That's the most significant thing that happened. Again, nobody that I knew at the time, I mean, people were deported, my parents, but I didn't know of anybody. These people are mostly people who came into Hungary from the hinterlands, I mean, from the community, the farming community outside of Budapest. And they were deported. There's no ghetto involved yet. We're living, again, still in our house. I still go to school. And, quote, my life is normal, unquote, if you want to call it that. As soon as he arrives in Hungary, within days, as I understand, he's approached by 2 men who are part of a self-appointed kind of rescue committee and they propose a deal to save people. Now, deals were being made and done in many countries, in Holland and other places, and some people were able to escape through these deals. The deal here is an absurd deal. The deal is, if Eichmann were to release 1 million people from the camps, 1 million, these two guys would see that he gets 10,000 trucks to be used against the Eastern Front. Now, there were several problems with this, as you can imagine. Even if Eichmann wanted to, he could not release 1 million people. He didn't have 1 million people anymore, not that late. And these guys didn't have a bicycle pump or a hubcap, not 10,000 trucks. One of the two is dispatched to go to Egypt under Swiss Guard, actually, to discuss with the British allies the question about trucks. I mean, they laughed at it. They arrested him in Aleppo in Syria, put him in jail in Cairo. He was in jail for the rest of the war, survived the war, and he was in jail for about a year as a spy. The other negotiator by the name of Rudolf Kastner, a Jewish lawyer from Romania, continues the negotiations, which eventually evolve into 1 million people and 10,000 trucks to about 1,700 and some people and a great deal of valuables to be carried in the suitcases. These negotiations went from Eichmann, who was a lieutenant colonel in the army, up to Himmler. Heinrich Himmler was number 3 in the Nazi government. He was the head of the SS. Now, I don't know how precisely he was involved, but he thought he would escape the end of the war, and when he was captured, he committed suicide with a cyanide pill. Eichmann wound up in Argentina and was captured there, and that's another story. But the point of Argentina is that he certainly didn't become a shoe salesman. He had the wherewithal to establish life for himself and whatever from the monies that he and others collected from these collective kind of deals that were made. However, because of these deals, I survived. So did my mother. My father did not. I mean, sorry. He survived, but not with us. An entirely different route was his survival story. But that's what happened when Eichmann arrived.
So when you were supposed to be part of this deal and, I believe, sent to Switzerland, correct?
No. Not quite. The deal was that since the Nazis' notion was to make Europe and the world eventually Judenrein, clean or clear of Jews. If you got them out of Germany, that's good. If you got them out of Europe, that's better. Eventually get them out of the world, which never happened. We're supposed to have been taken to a neutral port, maybe Spain or Turkey, and shipped by boat to Palestine because we claimed to be displaced persons. Now, folks, displaced persons we were about as displaced. I mean, our certificates were as real as a $3 bill. But for some unimaginable reason, the Nazis accepted those papers, much as they accepted a little bit later the papers that were issued by Raoul Wallenberg, the Swedish diplomat in Budapest, who issued Swedish passports or exit visas or citizenships. Those were about as valid as a $3 bill. But anyhow, we were in fact taken by train, one of those boxcars, 60 to 80 people per car, 1,700 of us, north, supposedly to be taken to a neutral port. How north was neutral, I don't know, because we were not going to be taken to a port at all. We were taken instead to a place called Bergen-Belsen, which none of us knew. After negotiations continued, about 6 weeks later, 350 of the people in this group were in fact taken by German troop train into Switzerland. I was not among them. I did my whole 5.5 months, almost 6 months of time, when we too were taken to Switzerland. So that my war ends in December of 1944. When the war actually ends, I'm in Switzerland. And I'll tell you one little anecdote about the war ending. It's a very important date. The war ends on the 8th of May, 1945, which is also the birthday of the President of the United States at the time, who is not Roosevelt.
Truman.
It's Harry Truman. Harry Truman was born May the 8th, 18 something or other, I don't know when, but he had birthday May the 8th. And it's particularly important to me because my birthday is also May the 8th. Ah. So the war Harry and I share.
Wonderful. Describe Bergen-Belsen.
Bergen-Belsen was a concentration camp, a transit or transfer camp. It was not a death camp. I mean, it was not a killing camp in that people were brought there to be killed. Lots and lots of folks died in Bergen-Belsen from malnutrition, from starvation, and from typhus. Typhus is a disease that today I've asked many, many physicians. Oh, yeah, I saw typhus once in third-year medical school on Tuesday, one slide. I mean, that's how they know about typhus. But typhus was rampant. It's a bacterial disease, I think. It has something to do with sanitation. And it kills you. Food was minimal. When you see the liberation of Bergen-Belsen, the Germans began to burn it to destroy the evidence, and the British destroyed it by bulldozing it. You see bulldozers pushing dead bodies into mass graves. As horrible as that sounds, it had to happen, because if they hadn't, everybody leaving Bergen-Belsen would have carried typhus with them, would have created the Black Plague of Europe of 1945. So Bergen-Belsen is a labor camp, a transit camp, at one time about 25,000 people. Because we were in this particular group of hostages, as it were, they did not kill us. I don't mean kill us. Didn't work us to death. Because obviously if they killed us, whichever way they killed us, they have nothing to negotiate with. They couldn't get the monies that came from all over the world, not just our money. They could not have had that kind of valuables if they had nothing to trade for. So we were given the same lack of rations, the same lack of housing, the same constant, again, the census every day outside in the mud for 2 and 3 and 4 hours. But we were not sent out to work, which probably saved. Nobody died in our group. And all 1,700 whatever number eventually arrived to Switzerland in two sections. So Bergen-Belsen was a place which was very unpleasant, but for us was a little bit less unpleasant than the next area right next to us, the next set of barracks which were next door to us, which I think was a Polish section, if I remember correctly. Couldn't talk to them, didn't speak Polish.
Just a couple of minutes before our next break, so you've explained what happened with you and your mother. You said earlier that your father survived in a different way. What happened to him?
Well, he was in labor camp. He was in labor camp in territorial Hungary until just about the time that we, in fact, were deported or taken out to, on our train ride to the ship, which turned out to be Bergen-Belsen. Around that time, for reasons that I cannot explain because nobody can, he and his brigade, regiment, whatever it was called, were taken out of Hungary into the Ukraine for similar work. Very primitive, very poor conditions. At some point in later 44, maybe in the early fall, while we are in Bergen-Belsen, he and a couple dozen of his buddies decided to take the risk of just walking away. By this time, the Germans were being pushed in one direction, the Russians were coming from another direction, and they were willing to take the chance of just walking away. They slept during the day, they walked during the night, they ate whatever they could find, they cooked potatoes in the exhaust of trucks, in the heat of the exhaust of the trucks, and they in fact walked back from the Ukraine to Budapest, which is a hike. My father's back in Budapest before the Russians arrive, and the Russians are the ones who liberated Budapest. So he survives, and eventually, and we did in fact from Switzerland, my mother would not go back to Hungary, in fact went south, as our original intention was, and wound up in then Palestine. So I was at that time a Palestinian, which I laugh about, because you talked about being a Palestinian, I'm not the one who you describe. He then followed us in 1946, and we all got reunited in Budapest, in Israel. Well, not yet, in Palestine, really, which then became Israel. So that's his story.
Let's pause briefly, and we'll come back with one more segment with Manny Mandel.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
We're in our final minutes with Holocaust survivor Emmanuel Manny Mandel. Sir, it's been an honor to have you with us today. When we left off a difficult story with a happy moment. You're finally reunited with your father, and your mother had been with you the whole time. You're in what would soon be Israel, but Palestine at that time. Explain what it was like to move to that completely foreign place to you at that point.
Let me precede that just by a quick comment about the fact that our family at this point is three people, my mother, my father, and I. People ask me if I have siblings, and I answer no, for two reasons. I mean, I don't answer for two reasons, but there are two reasons. One is that my father was over here, my mother was over there, and that's not the way you make babies. But more specifically, I think my parents, I mean, I know this not for as a fact, we never discussed it. They made a conscious decision that said we are not going to bring another child into the world. I was born in 36. His sibling would have come in 8, 9, 40, something like that, right? That's a reasonable span of kids. And I can kind of document it by saying to you that my mother comes from a family of six, three men and three women. In the aggregate, these six families had five children. It's a very low production rate, right?
Sure.
So here we are in Palestine. My father comes out. The first thing that had to happen is I had to kind of reacquaint myself with him. In 1946, I'm 10 years old. And from 7 or so to 10, those 3 years, or from 8 to 10, from 8 to 10, I don't see him at all. But from 6 to 8, I see him intermittently when he's called back and forth into the labor camp. Life in many ways was very exciting in Palestine and Israel with the creation of the state. And we were basically happy there. I said very much earlier that my grandfather, my father's father, was a kind of a minor functionary in the county government. He was not a successful businessman. He inherited apparently some significant amounts of stuff, I don't know whether it's property or livestock or whatever, from his in-laws, from my grandmother's parents. But he didn't do well with it. So in 1914, he decided to ship his eldest daughter to the United States to live with a cousin, to reduce the number of mouths he had to feed. Well, my father hadn't seen his sister in 35 years. He decided he'd like to come to the States to visit her. He lost two brothers and some others during the war. A very little family was left. He thought he would like to renew that acquaintance. She left so early that she never even met her youngest brother, who was born after she left home, my Uncle David. My father came here, and through a number of significant movements and some legal maneuvering that was able to manage, with the help of my then cousin, who's now gone, the son of this aunt, who was what is called a Philadelphia lawyer. He was with a major firm, and he was able to find some ways for my father to stay here and change his visitor visa to permanent residency, at which point he then wrote to us and said he wants us to do what we need to do and come here. So in March of 1949, we all were reunited here and have been here ever since. Now, I was not happy because I thought that Israel at the time was a very exciting place. I was 13 years old. I was old enough to understand what's going on, too young to be in the army. But there was a family vote, and I lost 2-1.
Sir, obviously there's much more we could get into following 1949, but it's also worth pointing out for our audience that you are still very active in making people aware of what happened with the Holocaust through your work with the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum.
Okay. I speak to groups. I travel for the museum some. I can tell you anecdotally, and I think it's interesting, even though it's only a minute, I did a trip in October to Pocahontas, Arkansas. You ever hear that?
No.
Nothing with Pocahontas that we know from the Indian stories, but sure. It's a community in Arkansas. 6,000 people who for 12 years have had a 3-day Holocaust commemoration and asked for a museum survivor to come down and speak at 5 or 6 different locations to hundreds of people. I do that. I speak to groups here. I do tours. I do some work at the museum. I'm not an interviewer. There's only so many things you can do, and there's only 7 days in a week.
Well, sir, thank you very much for all you do. Thank you for sharing your story with us. We appreciate you coming in today. I'm Greg Corumbus for Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network. Our guest today has been Emmanuel Manny Mandel, survivor of the Holocaust.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network in Washington, D.C. Veterans Chronicles is available wherever you are. Download podcasts of previous shows at TuneIn.com or Apple iTunes, or subscribe to upcoming podcasts at RadioAmerica.com.